Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to KPCW Radio, Park City. I have Erica Martin on the line with the ABC Forecast Center. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning. So today we have a great day in the forecast. Temperatures in the upper 80s. We're going to see mostly sunny skies to partly cloudy skies as the day continues. Now, I am tracking a couple of chances for some thunder showers later on this week, especially likely for tomorrow and Thursday. So temperatures are going to decline by tomorrow. We're going to see low 80s and then threat of those showers moving through our forecast region. Additionally, we could be one or two rounds of thunder showers late tonight, so that's what I'll also be tracking. But I really do think we're just going to see increasing clouds out there. So, of course, we'll be keeping you updated on that. And in the meantime, be sure that you keep in mind that we could see some dry thunder out there, the threat of dry lightning. That's really one of the bigger concerns right now, because we actually saw a fire that was triggered yesterday. It's called the Strawberry Fire. It was triggered by dry lightning. Now, Wednesday is going to be the coolest day of the week. We're going to see low 80s, perhaps an upper 70s. So we could be right at 79, 80 with the threat of those showers. We'll climb back into the mid 80s by Thursday. And then on Friday, we have a great day in the forecast, starting off partly cloudy. It initially looked like we could pick up an isolated shower, but we're going to go with partly cloudy skies. And this weekend looks absolutely gorgeous. A high of 86 on Saturday and 87 on Sunday with mostly sunny skies, increasing moisture for the second half of your Sunday into Monday. But a really great stretch overall. The only thing we're tracking really that would be of consequence would be the threat of those high base showers and that dry lightning, simply because we just saw what happened yesterday in Kane County with the Strawberry Fire. So just be mindful out there. If you see anything at all, make sure you call authorities right away.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Northbound US 40 will be reduced to one lane between the Mayflower exit and the Summit County line today from 9 to 6 p.m. They've got some bridge work that's going on there. So plan for heavy delays is the messaging we've got here. It will be again today, July 21st from 9 to 6. They're anticipating reducing to one lane also on Thursday, and we'll have more updates on that as we get them. It may not be quite as long of a project on Thursday. Well, NOAA calculations released last week project that the year 2020 is currently on pace to be the second hottest year on the planet since formal record keeping was established in 1880. In addition, NOAA states that there is a 35% chance that 2020 will surpass the hottest year on record, which was 2016. Sean Sublett, a meteorologist with Climate Central out of Princeton, New Jersey, will discuss these findings, why it's happening, and where the worst of it is occurring. That is on This Green Earth this morning, following NPR News at 9 a.m. Well, the Summit County Board of Health meeting on Monday voted to amend the county's mandatory mask order for young children. Rick Bruff reports the board decided on a compromise after hearing an appeal from a coalition of child care facilities.
The health board voted to deny, in part, the request from the SETA representing child care operations, which wanted an exemption from the mask order for children up to the age of 6. They did agree, however, to guidelines in a draft order that the county thinks will likely be issued soon by Governor Gary Herbert. The order says that toddlers up to age 3 will be exempted from wearing a mask. In addition, youngsters 3 years or older could be exempted if their parent, guardian, or caregiver feels that they can't safely place a mask on the child's face. The board heard from Rachel Barnett from PC Tots and Natalie Pepito of Kids Cabin, speaking for nearly 20 child care centers or providers. Barnett said the mask order is not a good fit for toddlers.
The way that the order is written, we feel as though it assumes that young children are small adults, in that they can developmentally and logically comprehend at the drop of a mandate that they need to keep masks on. And for multiple reasons, we feel as though within child care centers that is flawed, and we have observed that firsthand.
Pepito said that for the age group she works with, 2 to 4 years old, the masks can be a particular problem.
Little toddlers cry, even 3 and 4 year olds, and sometimes they get so dramatic that they end up holding their breath and can pass out. Another thing is if they throw up, which happens, you know, just happens. Also, when we're in a child care setting, having the mask on a toddler is very difficult for us to see if they put something in their mouth. And if you're a parent, you know that you can turn your back for 1 second and your toddler has put a chip or something in their mouth, and if that face covering is covering their mouth, I can't see if they're choking.
She added that if a mask causes a breathing problem, a toddler can't say something or will be too shy to speak up. Barnett said there's another problem if the adult caretakers constantly have to touch the children to keep the masks on their faces. She said the masks could lead to emotional episodes for kids, and when the coverings don't show facial expressions on other children or grown-ups, the youngsters are deprived of the visual cues they need for language or emotional development.
Furthermore, the European Journal of Pediatrics also pointed out that, of course, barriers are helpful in mitigating disease spread. However, you have to take into consideration the child's consent. And I really think that that's the crux of this. If the child doesn't consent, which is often, we cannot push it further. Being a Master's of Public Health graduate, it's also been my concern that that pushing it farther would traumatize them and could be a form of ACEs or adverse childhood experiences.
The health board chair, Alyssa Golding, said they certainly won't force masks on children or send cops into the centers, but they should do the best they can.
Yeah, maybe there are ways to incentivize it, to make it into a game, give out gold stars or, you know, whatever. It seems to me, obviously, it's a process. It's not going to happen overnight. It would be gradual, mm-hmm. and hopefully we get up to a high enough level that it's really effective and safe.
Finally, Health Board member Doug Evans said it's a tough issue, and he had some serious criticism for Governor Herbert.
I'm furious at the governor. When I heard him, I don't know if it was a week ago, I thought he was going to have the courage to mandate masks for adults. We're using language for these kids that should have been used for adults. And had the adults had the courage to do this, I don't think these kids would have to be wearing masks. I think he got it backwards. He's going, well, let's just dump all these rules on three-year-olds and let the adults do whatever they want. I'm just upset that we're even to this position because I think we as adults acted irresponsibly and now the kids are going to pay the price. Sorry, I didn't mean to go off, but it's...
You're here. That's all I have to say.
Health Board member Doug Evans. For KPCW, I'm Rhett Roth.
Good morning. It's 8:15. On the phone, we have Park City Fire Chief Paul Hewitt and Summit County Fire Warden Bryce Boyer. They are going to tell us about the just announced ban on fireworks in the unincorporated part of Summit County for this holiday coming up. And also perhaps give us an update on the fire season so far. I've been following some of the regional news, and it looks like we've got a pretty active season ahead of us. So good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Bryce, let me start with you. This fire season is being called an historic season, and that, from what I'm reading, many of the fires have been caused by humans. Yes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, a lot of our fires this year with COVID and people getting out into the open lands or federal and state lands have been creating a lot of the fires. Initially, it looked to be that it was a lot of campfires and so on that were not being put out, and they were leaving them, and then they flare up. As we went into the 4th of July and now into the 24th of July, where we've had multiple weeks of dry weather with low humidity, high temps, fireworks have become quite the cause, as well as the leaving campfires either unattended or not putting them out. So with that, I was asked by the council to look into doing a fireworks restriction based on how dry we've gotten. In the lower elevations, it's still kind of moister once you get up above 8,000 to 9,000 feet, so up in the forest and so on. We did the request. It was approved Monday morning. So as of Monday morning, the 20th through November 30th, there is no fireworks in unincorporated private and county-owned lands. Cities are, when I talked with them yesterday, they are discussing whether or not they are going to completely ban them within their jurisdiction or within city limits. or just do partial areas where it would threaten going up onto the hillsides and so on. Another reminder is that fireworks are always illegal on federal land, so any of the Forest Service, BLM, ground around, they're always illegal or not allowed to be set off on Forest Service property, as well as back prior to the 4th of July, the state had done a ban on all state-owned lands. So that would include state parks, that type of thing, as well as the DWR grounds and so on in Summit County. That would be over in the Hennifer Echo area.
So, Bryce, it's interesting. You've sort of cut through a lot of the jurisdictions. Where are fireworks allowed?
Right now, they are still allowed within incorporated city limits, but people need to check with their local city officials or city websites to ensure that they have not done anything at this, passed any kind of restrictions or cordoned off certain areas due to the fire danger.
Sure.
It's gotten really dry. I mean, we've had a little over 3 weeks now since just prior to the 4th. Of no precipitation, no rain. Humidities have been running in the low teens to single digits with upper 90 to mid 90 degree temperatures. Our only saving factor in fire issues, wildland fires, particularly up here in the Summit area, has been that we have not seen those winds like the other areas when they had their fires. 2 weeks ago, we had one on Saturday. It was someone burning without a permit. It got away, and we were actually starting to see the oak brush be the primary carrier of those fires. So with that information, passing it on to our elected folks, county council, county manager, assistant manager, emergency managers, the decision was made to request of the state forester for a fireworks ban, because any sparks from those is likely to start a fire. We just got info on our weather reports and so on that it looks like we could be seeing the monsoonal flow start coming in, and that's been being covered on the TV media locally, and that's going to bring the winds. Initially, the first Wednesday and Thursday, it's probably going to come in very dry, which means we could see dry lightning, which can tap out our resources quickly, because it'll be dry lightning, but the winds also come with those to move those fronts in. It looks that by Thursday, Friday, we could start seeing some precipitation. But even with that, as dry as it's been, as soon as the sun comes back out, it's going to dry those fine fuels, the grasses, and so on out. So fireworks would be a very big threat with being able to start a fire.
Sure. So it sounds like a harrowing set of conditions coming up. Let's turn to Paul Hewitt with he's the fire chief, Park City Fire Chief. Paul, what would it take? I mean, what would it take for the city to say, no fireworks, we're not doing it?
What would it, I'm sorry, I apologize. I got a text coming right when you said that. What would it take to do?
What would it take for the city to say, we're not doing fireworks? I mean, this forecast sounds pretty harrowing in terms of possible dry lightning, very dry conditions, warm temperatures.
So the city generally will take a cautious approach with fireworks, and they always have. The return on investment is what the city is going to look at. So if I were any parkite here, I wouldn't be planning on discharging fireworks during this season. The city has a very good track record of taking the cautious approach, and that's exactly what they should be doing.
And have you made that recommendation to the city?
Well, the city has their own fire marshal, so our fire marshal works in conjunction with the city, and they study the fuel loads, and that's something that they're currently in process of. And I wouldn't doubt for a second that they'll not allow fireworks in the city limits. In fact, like I say, a fire park doesn't really plan on. I wouldn't be out buying a lot of the fireworks right now.
Right. So that it was an interesting thing you just said, return on investment. I'm kind of curious, how do you calculate what a wildfire costs taxpayers? Is there some calculus used for that?
Yes. Well, the calculus is that the COVID has been a big threat to our economy here, obviously, and it's given us much disruption in our economy here locally. A wildfire has every bit of the potential of any pandemic, of doing the exact same thing, and every local official here, from Mayor Andy Bierman to Matt Dias to the county manager, Tom Fisher, they all understand that wildfire represents an ongoing, constant threat to this area, and they deal with it just like that. So they take the cautious approach. It's definitely in their purview under state code to reduce the danger and the threats of wildfire. And I'll tell you, as a fire chief's perspective, I'm really proud of the local leaders here and what they're doing and how they approach this threat.
So would each of the incorporated areas of Summit County get to decide what they want to do for this holiday weekend? Colville decides, Camas decides, Oakley, so forth?
Yeah, Carolyn, that's precisely right. That's within the purview of each. And each of the jurisdictions, each of the cities has different terrain, different considerations. So through state code, the municipalities have that right. And the unincorporated, we're a 110 square mile district. The Park City Fire District is where about 80% of the Summit County's population resides. So we have an unincorporated area in the Snyderville Basin, and that's been taken care of very well by the county council, the deputy manager, and the county manager, and Bryce Boyer that was just on the phone. They've handled that threat well in the Snyderville Basin. And the city, Park City, and my fire district has always done a very good job of watching the conditions. Like Bryce said, it looks like we're going to have some rain in our forecast, but it's too little too late. These decisions are very dynamic decisions, and you have to take the most cautious approach. And that's exactly what they've been doing. They will take the cautious approach. I have all the faith in the world of the Park City will look at it very seriously and make the right decision.
Okay. Hey, you know, I between the two of you, I don't know how closely you follow wildfire updates in other counties, but, you know, we've been reporting on the Wasatch County Big Hollow Fire for the last week or so. Human caused is what it was determined. Have either of you gotten an update on that? And do we know what did cause it at this point?
They're still trying to track down, like they were saying in other media outlets and releases. They're still trying to talk to witnesses and determine the exact cause and location. That's all they've really been releasing at this point, but they are making individual contact with eyewitnesses.
Okay, and that will, I mean, is that type of an investigation something that might continue for months, or is it something that usually you can get to the bottom of pretty quickly?
It could take a couple of months to get through till you get the information coming out. We dealt with a series of human-started fires in Colville City Limits here a week or so ago. And for over a 48-hour period, we had 8 fires started within the city limits. They didn't really get anywhere. Fire Department, North Summit Fire, and myself were in the area because after the first two, we realized we probably had an issue going on. So I was spending a lot of my time up in that area and were able to catch them quickly, but it took till the 8th fire when we actually started to get some folks coming forward, witnesses, and be able to patch together a possible suspect. We brought in the state investigator as well as the Summit County Sheriff's Office. They were able to talk to a few people and it stopped our fires, but we didn't have enough to do a prosecution on it. And they are still looking at that one.
Yeah, Paul?
Carolyn, some of these fires are so simple. I heard of a fire that was started in the Salt Lake Valley that a boy took a Roman candle and was shooting it at his friends on the hillside and started the fire. And so the fire was raging, and the fire department showed up, and the girls just came back and said, hey, my boyfriend was shooting the Roman candle at me. That's how that fire started. So investigation, some of it's as simple as that. Some of it takes 30 seconds, and others they have to look through the ignition source. But I guess the point of our conversation is here is fireworks are a definite ignition source, especially when they're used inappropriately. We have consumer-grade fireworks that are allowed, that are legal when they're allowed, and they're not allowed right now. And then we have the fireworks that you can bring across the border that are the mortars. And we have a lot of those coming into our – luckily, we have not had a lot of residents that are real interested in firing off the mortars. July 4th, I usually get a whole bunch of phone calls during that evening, and this year it was patted down. So anybody listening out there, don't bring any illegal fireworks in here. That's when the sheriff has to get involved.
Sure.
And those mortars represent the illegal to the state of Utah always, the above the consumer grade and the simple fireworks like snakes and stuff. Don't bring those in. Don't allow anybody to bring them in. If you see the mortars going off, by all means, call 911. I'll send a fire engine out there and we'll stop it immediately.
Okay. And same thing with hearing them. I mean, oftentimes on a holiday, you hear it just popping off through the night. I mean, until the early hours of morning.
Right. And they're illegal. So that's why we have 7 staff fire stations and our guys can get out there and work with the sheriff to make sure that
right.
These sources of ignitions are and threats are held to a minimum.
So just to capture all of this, basically backyard ballistics, stay away from it this year. It's just even if you're in the city, until of course I guess the city allows that to happen, and that's what we're going to find out in the next couple of days here, I suppose.
Precisely. Just follow the city on the city's website.
Okay.
And they'll keep residents updated on that.
Okay. Well,
the other point I would like to make so that people don't think we're just trying to take away their rights, we're afraid of having to go out and put out fires. The fires can create a lot of damage. But if people look back, we had no restrictions for the 4th of July. That was based on these weather conditions and so on. We look at the weather conditions. The only time we're looking at doing a restriction or banning the use of them is when those weather conditions dictate that. We did not restrict them over the 4th of July because of the fuel moistures and everything were at a safe level. And we had no fireworks fires over the 4th of July this year.
Okay. Okay, well,
that is a different story right now. We're in a much different position with our vegetation and fuels out there. Please do not do fireworks.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. That's Bryce Boyer. He is with the Summit County. He's the Summit County Fire Warden. And we've had Park City Fire Chief Paul Hewitt on the line to give us an update. Thank you so much, gentlemen. I appreciate you calling in this morning.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's 8:33, and this is the KPCW Local News Hour. I have Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson on the line. Good morning, Bruce. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Carolyn.
So I do want to talk about the Park City Mountain Resort base area parking lot development is not on the agenda. It's being continued. But let's first start off by talking about what is on the agenda. Maybe we can circle back to that after we've kind of gone through what is happening tomorrow for your Planning Commission meeting.
Well, there's a couple of things. And you know, the Planning Commission has got their hands full with 300 pages of staff report. And it's mainly adjustments to the land management code to make it easier to read, make it easier to enforce, make some recommendations with respect to affordable housing and, you know, details like that, which is very complicated to go through and would put a normal person to sleep in about a half a second. So we owe the planning commissioners a great deal of respect for their ability to do it. I think what you're seeing, Carolyn, is a shift in staff philosophy of trying to make the land management code much more viable and much more understandable to the public rather than just regulating projects. And that's why you're seeing page after page after page of red line and code changes. I can go through some of the big ones for you, but I think the key crux ones are probably in the affordable master plan development approach.
And you mean the affordable housing, the position we take. Yeah, I think that that is probably one interesting element that people would like to understand.
Right. So there's actually four approaches to this one, three of which are represented in the staff report tomorrow night, which is let's talk about how we incentivize and increase the ability for public-private partnerships for affordable projects. The second one is how do we align our land management code with the housing resolution? And do we really need to increase the requirement for housing inside some of our larger projects? The third one is making sure all of our definitions are clear and we have the opportunity to, encourage additional dwelling units inside of our projects in accordance with the approvals. And the fourth one that's not showing up in this staff report is how we handle accessory dwelling units and accessory apartments, which we talked about at the last Planning Commission meeting. So there's four approaches that Planner Tyler and Planner Ward are working on to try and get more affordable housing in town at the direction of the City Council. So we're changing the affordable master plan development section. We're trying to get aligned with the housing resolution. We're looking at land management code changes, and we're looking at the definitions of accessory dwelling units and accessory apartments.
Okay. Now, also at, last meeting, there was some discussion about giving serious consideration to raising the housing requirements on some of the larger employees. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I can. I mean, the resorts have always been under the gun because they have these large-scale 20-year-long agreements with the city to develop. But there's a number of large property owners and large operators in the city that have no affordable housing requirements at all. And none that I'm aware of any of the housing projects in town have any affordable housing unit requirements. So while the resorts take the brunt of all of this, there's a whole bunch of other operators out there that don't have any responsibilities at all. And that's going to be a hard conversation with the City Council saying, what do you want us to do here?
And what is the thought? I mean, right now, it runs from 10 to 20% affordable housing along with developments? What would you...
Yeah, in the resort master plans, yes. But, if you were to develop a grocery store, there's no requirement. The hospital has a high level of requirement out there. IHC in Queens Junction has a requirement. The National Abilities Center fulfilled their requirement with their housing for their own guests. The Peace House, it doesn't necessarily have a requirement, but they're filling their requirement by providing housing services for the folks that need them. So it's pretty convoluted. I think the question is, Carolyn, what's coming next where we can make a bold change into requiring additional affordable housing requirements? I don't see Park Meadows growing anymore. I don't see Thames Canyon growing anymore. I only see minor changes in the historic district. That's kind of where we are on that thing, is we're not seeing any major changes, and I don't know that we can go backwards and raise our affordable housing standards on those folks that have a development agreement with us.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a very complicated issue, and you'll be talking about this at the meeting tomorrow then.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Actually, Hannah Tyler will be talking about it. I'll just be sitting in the background watching her work.
Okay. I know she works hard, doesn't she? Okay.
Yes.
Also discussing electric vehicle charging stations. Can you talk a little bit about how you calculate how many are needed and where they're needed?
I think we sort of did that at the last meeting. But there's a requirement inside of the new code for electrical vehicle charging stations, and I don't have that number right in front of me right now, excuse me, where we're going to start requiring them. And the conversation with the Planning Commission is that we want to do what they call a level 2 charging station, which allows for quick charging. A level 1 charging station takes all night, and that is pretty slow. So a level 2 is a nice compromise where you can come in for a couple hours, get charged up, and then go away and reserve the space for another user. Sort of the hard conversations that we're having here is whether how many electronic vehicle stations do we require or should we require for a single-family house or a duplex or a triplex or a multifamily unit section. So we're still having those conversations with the Planning Commission about what should be required and what should we be making sure is available to the public.
Okay, and it's not on the agenda, but it was discussed at last week's meeting.
Yeah, it was discussed at the last meeting.
And will those requirements end up working their way into the code as well?
Absolutely. They have to live in the code when we get them negotiated with the Planning Commission and the City Council.
Yeah, sure. Okay, anything else you want to talk about with the agenda for tomorrow?
Let me just look here real quick. We were going to talk a little bit about Park City Mountain Resort Base. So the meeting for tomorrow night was designed to start the conversation about site design and building size and accessibility and circulation. Excuse me, that's been passed off until August 2020 while we continue to have conversations about what we talked about in the last meeting, which is a new master plan development rather than an amendment to the existing master plan development. And that's a hard conversation because there's so many overlaps between the resort operator and the base area operator and the fact that the development agreement is from 1998. So we're trying to get that all cleaned up, and then we'll have a conversation about how the base area design starts to work, where the height may go, where the setbacks may go. How do we have a conversation about Empire Avenue and the detached housing on Empire Avenue on the east side of the street, and then sort of a big resort on the other side of the street? All that's coming up on August 26th. And then we're going to move to affordable housing in September. And then we're going to move to October and November. We're going to have a whole bunch of public meetings.
Okay. And has the name of this project changed? I was looking at your notes. You're now calling it the Park City Mountain Resort Base Concept Master Plan. what are we calling it now?
Well, The development agreement in 98 called it the concept master plan. So we're trying to align this project with the 98 agreement until we change the 98 agreement. See, it is a concept master plan. We can call it the base area development. We can call it Park City Mountain Resort base area. I think everybody recognizes what it is, but there's some technical underpinnings that people like me and Planner NF need to work through.
Right, and it is just conceptual at this point. And Planner Aneth had also commented in her notes from the last meeting that she really recommends, I mean, her recommendation is to, you know, make a new master plan, to not just revise the existing, because there are so many things that impact it, the number of parking spaces, whether they're above ground or below ground, setbacks, heights, density, encroachment onto the golf course, all those things. So there's a lot to sort through here,
Sounds like. She has her hands full. The Planning Commission at the last meeting agreed to make it a new master plan. So they agreed with Planner Anoth on how to handle this situation. Now it's kind of up to me and the legal department to see what that framework wants to look like inside of a development agreement.
Okay, so that's the next step then.
That's what's coming out the other end when we're done here, is there'll be a development agreement which lays out all the side information that needs to go along with this master plan.
Okay, and how does go ahead, I'm sorry.
Things like how does the transit operate, who manages the parking lots, where do oversized vehicles park if the parking lots are all 7 feet tall for cars? How is the affordable housing split up between the two agencies? Who handles the other drop-offs in the street. All those kind of things need to happen in conjunction with both bodies.
So, Bruce, how does having made that decision that there needs to be a new master plan, how does that affect the timing that the applicants have been trying to kind of work under, which would be to start digging next spring?
Depending on the public input and depending on how quickly we work through this with the Planning Commission and how receptive the developers are to the Planning Commission's input. Right now, Planner Anance is scheduled for a November and December hearing. So assuming we can stay on track here, we're looking at November or December for a decision.
Okay, which would give them time to get going in the spring if that's what they are.
Yeah, that would give them probably 3 or 4 months to get the building permits in and have the building department approve the building permits and try and make the final adjustments on how they're going to construct parking in order to be ready for the winter season with the same number of parking spaces that they have now.
Okay, great. Anything else, Bruce, you want to add?
No, thank you. I just want to send my appreciation out to you guys and also the planners that have written thousands of pages of code in the last month.
Yes, and it is dry reading. Okay. Hey, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Carolyn. I appreciate it. Bye.
That's Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson.
Support for KPCW comes from NOAA, who believes that in times of uncertainty, a modern home financing partner can help meet a family's financial goals. Learn more at noaa.co/parkcity.
Back to school is often an exciting time for kids and families. With the COVID-19 state-mandated school closures in March, districts are working to come up with a game plan to bring everyone back safely. And today, the Wasatch County School Board will vote on a plan which will give students and parents options for how they will return to class this fall. A Wasatch School District survey shows most parents want their kids to return to school all day with a normal schedule. The survey outlined 4 scenarios, with 60% of parents preferring the option of returning with typical class sizes and increased safety and hygiene protocols. This option suggests face coverings for teachers and staff, while students would use them only if they can't maintain a 6-foot separation from others. Academic Director Garrick Peterson says under the plan they propose, parents would have leeway to decide what's best for their students.
Very concerned about the academic learning of their students, especially coming off of online school the last 2 months of the school year, which I feel we did well, but it still isn't the same as regular school. The physical well-being of students and staff is a high concern, and then the social and emotional well-being of students and staff. And one of the things we've realized is different people are prioritizing those 3 things on different levels, and it's guiding their decisions when it comes back to school and what they want. And it could be very different for different people.
Another option is a hybrid schedule with AM and PM face-to-face class time for core subjects. Electives and non-core subjects would be online and be accessed from home. The third scenario is 100% online. However, just 8% of those surveyed parents picked that option. And then homeschool, the fourth option, is always available to parents in Utah. If the board approves the plan with all 4 options, parents will have some decision on how they want their kids back in classes. Peterson says offering an online instruction option to students won't add more to a teacher's workload.
Our teachers will basically be responsible mostly for option 1, and then the half day face-to-face, but it shouldn't be any more work on them at all, because they'll just be instructing and but half their kids will be in class and half will be at home watching the class online. But it won't be any extra work, as far as they'll just be watching the instruction. So it should be a fairly normal setup for our teachers, not much additional work at all, because we're very good in Wasatch School District at defining what it is we want students to learn and creating assessments and assignments that align with those things.
Peterson says federal CARES funding covers the cost of PPE, and they'll supply a gator mask for each student. They are experimenting with teachers using face shields, especially with the elementary schools, because facial expressions are so critical for children's development and learning. Teachers and staff who have concerns about being back in the school facilities will be addressed individually.
But even in the regular classroom, we feel that things are going to be safe. We we've got masks, we've got these mitigation pieces in place, and we think we've done as much as we can, but we still are listening to our teachers, and there are some who have circumstances that are a little bit iffy, and we'll try to accommodate those people to the fullest that we can.
Peterson says it's important for some cultural changes to occur with students and staff with signs of illness. The district wants people to stay at home. The quarantine period for people with COVID-19 is 14 days, which can put added pressure on hiring more substitutes.
You know, if there's a situation where a teacher has to be out a couple of weeks, we are going to need more subs. So we're thinking through different plans, probably hiring some more permanent subs that are in our system all the time, knowing that we'll need those as we go. But the details of that are still being worked out.
The Wasatch County School District Board is meeting on Tuesday at 6:30. Agendas are posted at the entrance to the Wasatch Education Center at 101 East 200 North in Heber City, and a link to the virtual meeting can be found on the district's website. Well, we're trying to get the director of Recycle Utah on the phone here, and just stay with us for a minute and we'll give you an update on what's happening over there. Well, just be aware that there is some construction that will cause delays. It's northbound on US 40. It will be reduced to one lane between the Mayflower exit and the Summit County line beginning today at 9 a.m. and it will run through 6 p.m. There is bridge work that is going on, and UDOT says plan for heavy delays. Well, Park City's council discussed a range of issues from walkability to small business relief funds last week at their weekly Thursday meeting. KPCW's Sean Higgins has the details.
Since the voters of Park City approved a $15 million walkability bond in 2007, the city has spent over $10 million improving paths, bridges, and intersections in Park City. With just under $5 million left in the fund, the city has around $600,000 set aside for 2020 projects that include improved bike lanes on Deer Valley Drive and State Route 224, stairs in Old Town, and bike corrals on Main Street. However, funding for future projects presents an interesting challenge for city government. With many big projects yet to be completed, City Council debated the importance and priority of several spendy items on Thursday. Pedestrian safety around the intersection of Park Avenue and Kearns Boulevard, as well as on side streets like Snow Creek Drive, have only become more of an issue as Park City has grown in recent years. Councilmember Max Doylney says projects around those issues should be prioritized.
At some point, it needs to become a priority, in my opinion, because the lion's share of our residents now live on that side of town, and all the good stuff is on this side of the road, and traffic's not getting better.
Another expensive future project is a proposed bridge or tunnel across Bonanza Drive near the Future Arts and Culture District and Prospector Square. With that project expected to cost in the millions of dollars, the council agreed to explore the possibility of linking funding for that project to the construction budget for the Arts and Culture District instead of the walkability fund. The council will also be looking into options to continue funding walkability projects after the 2007 bond money runs out. One proposal floated by Mayor Andy Bierman on Thursday was earmarking a percentage of the budget used for city transit to fund future walkability projects. The council voted to research this option and present its findings at a future council meeting. The health of Park City's small businesses was also a top priority on Thursday. At the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, City Council voted to approve a $250,000 small business support program that is separate from federal coronavirus relief funds. With the pandemic yet to let up in Utah, the council debated the best course of action going forward. Councilmember Steve Joyce says although some businesses were ultimately able to adapt to the situation and are having a successful summer, many others are struggling. 40% of respondents to a recent Park City Chamber survey said their businesses would not survive another 3 to 12 months if nothing changed. Joyce says the hard part will be identifying businesses that could benefit the most from help from the city.
There's a number of companies that are, you know, just really impacted by this downturn, but given the right chance and they're modifying their business and they're finding ways to adapt, some of those are going to kind of figure it out and make it work. There's other businesses that simply aren't.
Councilmember Tim Henney also expressed his strong belief the funds should be distributed as grants and not loans. He says he does not want to further burden businesses in the future.
I only have interest in grants. I don't want to make these loans. I don't want to make them conditioned. These are grants. If we're not doing grants, I'm really not interested, quite honestly.
Due to the unique seasonal nature of Park City's economy, the council decided it would be best to hold off on distributing any of their relief money in the near future and instead continue to monitor the situation as the winter tourist season approaches. Mail delivery in Old Town Park City was also on the agenda. Park City's post office is unable to deliver mail to many residences in Old Town due to steep and narrow streets. Citizens in Old Town who want mail must use a P.O. box. City Council voted down allowing cluster mailboxes in Old Town in both 2011 and 2013, citing right-of-way issues and aesthetics as the main reasons. With the post office now willing to deliver to cluster mailboxes, the council moved to conduct a survey to determine how many Old Town addresses would need to be served by the post office before making any decisions. The next City Council meeting will be on Thursday, July 30th. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
History is being made every single day. As it happens, you need reliable information to help decipher what it means for you. And that is our specialty. Listen to Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
Starting at 5 a.m. on KPCW.
It is 8:59. You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray. Stay safe and be sure to tune in tomorrow starting at 7 a.m. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. And we're going to take you to NPR News in just a moment. Stay tuned, of course, for this Green Earth program starting at 9 o'clock. Well, a little after 9:07. And Noah will be on the line to talk about a meteorologist with Climate Central out of Princeton, will be on the line to talk about some of Noah's calculations that were released last week. Thanks for listening.